In practical terms, nothing will change, quote unquote. That was the response of U.S. military spokesman General Stephen Lanza to the New York Times, commenting on the withdrawal of thousands of U.S. combat troops in Iraq. President Obama has touted the withdrawal as fulfilling his longtime promise to end the war in Iraq. However, 50,000 U.S. troops remain on 94 military bases in the country. Official word from the military is that the remaining troops are vested with the power to advise and train the nascent Iraqi army, provide security, and carry out counterterrorism operations. Echoing the words of General Lanza, a journalist for The Guardian called the so-called withdrawal a nothing more than a, quote, rebranding of the occupation. Heavy criticism is also being aimed at plans to increase the use of military contractors, even though this outsourced workforce has been highly controversial and expensive. The Iraqi government is considered by many to be practically non-functional, and results from the March elections are still under dispute. July was the deadliest month in 2 years, with 535 civilians killed, much more than in Afghanistan. August has seen near-constant bombings with a series of attacks throughout the country last Wednesday that killed at least 45 people in total and wounded many more. Iraqi military forces and police recruits have been specifically targeted in many of the bombings. Tomorrow, President Obama will address the nation in a speech that is anticipated to outline the administration's strategies in Iraq and Afghanistan. My guest is Hadani Ditmars. She's a journalist and writer who's traveled to Iraq many times between 1997 and 2003. She recently returned in March of this year. She's also the author of the best-selling 2006 book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq, and also currently a co-editor at the New Internationalist magazine. Welcome to Uprising, Hadani.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So U.S. combat operations in Iraq are essentially being renamed stability operations. 50,000 U.S. troops will remain. So some troops have withdrawn, but 50,000 still remain. Is that enough to justify the use of the term withdrawal?
Well, it's all a bit of smoke and mirrors, isn't it? I mean, because, as you know, the U.S. military presence has not been kind of on the ground in the city's presence for a couple of years at least now. When we talk about withdrawal, it's not as if, you know, that the streets of Baghdad have, you know, just last week been full of American soldiers and now won't be. We're talking about them sort of withdrawing from outlying bases and areas. And, of course, there's still a huge U.S. presence in Iraq. An American embassy the size of Vatican City, several desert bases, et cetera, that are going to remain. But, I mean, I think we shouldn't really be focusing so much on the withdrawal. What we really have to look at are the larger systemic issues, the huge humanitarian catastrophe that Iraq is experiencing at the moment, where 7 years after the invasion, as you can read about in the May issue of New Internationalist, which I traveled back to Baghdad in February, March to write and photograph, 7 years later, the legacy of this invasion is that 43% of Iraqis live in abject poverty, 70% don't have access to clean drinking water, huge unemployment rate, terrible security situation, drastic decline in the status of women, and a secular society that has become Islamicized in a bad way. I mean, I don't even want to call it Islamicized. Just a militia rule has become the norm. So I think we have to look at these larger underlying issues. I don't think that this so-called withdrawal is really going to affect those issues one way or another. It could have a short term, as it has in the past several weeks, upswing in violent attacks, a further deterioration of the security situation. But the underlying issues and the underlying damage that has been done by this disastrous invasion and occupation are still there. Mm-hmm. It's still need to be addressed.
Now, what is the so-called advisory role that the U.S. troops will play to the Iraqi army? What does that mean?
Well, you know, I don't work for the Pentagon, so I can't tell you exactly, but I assume that it's going to be a very hands-on approach rather than arm's length. At the same time, there is this sense of abandonment. I mean, I'm sure you read the Tariq Aziz interview in The Guardian a few weeks ago where he said that Iraq is not ready and that to the Americans, by withdrawing, are abandoning Iraq to the wolves. Well, I would say that Iraq has already been abandoned to the wolves, sadly. So this could just make a bad situation worse. It's not really a full withdrawal. It's not really the end of the occupation, but in terms of an advisory role, perhaps there will still be some sort of military advice going on. It's really just kind of window dressing, as I say, for the larger issues. There's still a political power vacuum. There's still a huge issue around sectarian violence and sectarian strife. It's a bit frustrating when you've been covering Iraq for as long as I have, since 1997, that obviously, the media in the West is primarily interested in Iraq when there's some news that really is more about America than Iraq, when there's been a bombing or even the elections, which were kind of pseudo-democratic, I would say. There was a flurry of media interest in Iraq. But it's very difficult to get people interested in, the status of women and how it's declined drastically, or in the larger issue of how this once secular society has become radicalized and fundamentalist, et cetera. So, I think obviously the $53 billion that's been spent on quote-unquote aid, a lot of that has gone to military hardware in the name of military advisory activities. A lot of that has gone into the pockets of American military contractors. So, and of course, to this growing army of mercenaries.
And I want to ask you about that further privatizing of the occupation. But first, what do ordinary Iraqis, what is the view of most Iraqis? Obviously, it's not going to be homogeneous, but if you can give us a sense of what most Iraqis think about the security situation in their country, it would be helpful.
Well, I don't know if you read the issue that I wrote and photographed, but there is a fellow I met, Muwafaq Al-Tayyi, who's a 68-year-old architect and former Saddam-era town planner. And he's quite an interesting fellow because as he was being forced to build these terrible villas for Saddam, he was also a communist and a Shia, so he was being spied upon at the same time. And then he was almost killed by U.S. troops when he was post-invasion, when he was doing a project with the Marsh Arabs. So he's rather philosophical, as are many Iraqis, and he says in the issue, that Iraqis, always sort of make do, and anarchy is the mother of invention, and we'll get through this. But there's this incredible sort of resilience that people have, which I just find staggering, really, because the average Iraqi has been through so much. At the time of elections, they were quite cynical about what was going on, and rightly so, because there was, nothing really in the way of campaign finance laws. There were incumbents like Ahmed Chalabi who were simultaneously running for office and at the same time, nixing the bids of rival opponents under the auspices of their infamous debasification commission. Government forces were rounding up opponents and jailing them under trumped-up terrorism charges. So, some Iraqis, a lot of Iraqis I met were not voting, and they were quite cynical about it. At the same time, when the polling stations were being bombed, this sort of encouraged Iraqis to actually get out and vote, almost in spite of what was going on. Lately, when I've been speaking with Muwafaq in Baghdad, he just says, well, we're just getting on with it, the country isn't really being run by the politicians. It's being run by the Iraqi people, and we're just trying our best to make do. It's almost like they've been set adrift. They have no real functioning state. And this is really a contrast from, of course, the Ba'athist years when the state was the great provider, when Iraq had the best public health and education system in the Arab world. Having said that, the state still remains the main employer. So... It's it's really sad to see what's happened to the country. Going back even for the first time in 7 years, I was shocked just to see how Baghdad had been so completely broken and colonized and walled off into sectarian neighborhoods. If you look at the fact spread in the May issue of New Internationalist, there's some quite damning statistics, but there's also a very telling map of Baghdad, one from 2003, from before the invasion, and one from 2008. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, but you'll see that in 2003, most of the neighborhoods were mixed, meaning Sunni, Shia, Christian, Muslim, Arab, Kurd. After the invasion in 2008, the majority of the, and particularly after the sectarian wars of 2006 and 2007, most of Baghdad neighborhoods were sectarian enclaves and the majority Shia. So the whole social fabric of, not to mention the political landscape, has shifted radically.
Hmm.
And Iraqis are really, I think, just left reeling from it all and trying to struggle for daily survival.
I'm speaking with Hadani Ditmars. She's a journalist and writer and the author of the best-selling 2006 book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. She's also the co-editor at the New Internationalist magazine, and she wrote and photographed the latest issue. And you can find out more at her website, hadanidittmars.com. We'll also link to it from our site where you can and from her site, you can buy autographed copies of her best-selling book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. Let's talk about the mercenaries, the military contractors, of which there are, I believe, 100,000 private contractors that are working for the remaining U.S. occupation forces. What exactly are these private contractors doing, and what does it mean for Iraqis that they're going to increase the number of private contractors, even as they've decreased the number of U.S. troops?
Well, I think your listeners are probably familiar with the infamous antics of Blackwater, et cetera. But this is, of course, not a new situation. There's been mercenaries on the ground since right after the invasion. And it's not a phenomenon that's unique to Iraq either. I understand the U.S. military does this kind of thing in other places as well, this sort of privatizing of the army. When I was there in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, there were a lot of Hondurans that I met who seemed to be literally dying to get their green cards, because this was sort of a way for them to, become a full-fledged U.S. citizen. And so there were a lot of foreign nationals doing that kind of security work, and then there were the sort of the other category of former SAS types who were doing more senior and better-paid sort of mercenary jobs. So there certainly has been a lot of contracting out. It's a tragic situation. I guess I'm less interested in foreign mercenaries than I am in the fate of the Iraqi people and in their culture and how it's been destroyed. So I don't know if you want to talk to me about that, but what can I say? More mercenaries, bad news. Mm. I think we're all familiar with their track record on human rights and assassinations, and it can't be a good thing. It can't be a good thing.
Well, finally, let's talk about the results of the elections. There's still a lot of discussion about and disagreement about the results of the elections themselves. There was a sense that a civil war could come out of the strife and the elections. Tell our listeners what happened with the March elections, and I believe you were there in Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was. Well, as I said a few minutes ago, the elections, in fact, were in many ways a kind of a pseudo democracy, because, as I just explained, there were all kinds of violations of basic sort of election rules and ethics. Not the least of which was that incumbents were allowed to campaign with state funds. And, well, they were running themselves. In the instance of, for example, Ahmed Chalabi, they were also disqualifying rivals under the debathification laws. So, and of course, I think, your listeners were probably familiar or perhaps not with the fact that Maliki's troops were quite busy rounding up opponents and jailing them mm-hmm. under trumped-up terrorism charges. That said, and the cynicism expressed by many people that I talk to from all walks of life and sectarian backgrounds, not just the Sunnis, the sort of disaffected Sunnis, but, you know, working-class Shias, all kinds of people said, I'm not voting. Because of the bombing of the polling stations, there was this kind of sense of I'm out of defiance and I'm going to go out and vote, you know, whatever the cost. So there was actually quite a high voter turnout. And there was a certain amount of enthusiasm for the elections as well, in terms of the numbers of people who were running as candidates, whether they had a chance of winning or not, was another question. But everyone from the former orchestra conductor of the Iraqi National Orchestra to a Sufi sheikh to a woman journalist that I used to know who had worked for CNN, they were all running for office. But, you know, really, now we're at this political impasse. Iraq remains the fifth most corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International. So I feel that, you know, Iraqis are really losing faith in the political process. And as I said, their daily lives have now been reduced to this quite stark struggle for survival.
Well, Hadani Ditmars, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll link to your website from our site later. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hadani Ditmars is a journalist and writer who is the author of the book Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq.